Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, welcoming you to this Monday morning edition of The Cross in the Desert. So excited to be here as always today. Very, very special interview with my good friend Kaveh Tahari, all the way calling in live from Turkey. He's going to talk about his time where he was a political prisoner and the incredible suffering he endured. He's also going to talk about a current prisoner on death row that we are petitioning and speaking out for, and he will be a wonderful guest coming up in about 28 minutes. Also today, we're going to hear from the exiled prince, that is the son of the late Shah, Reza Pahlavi, and he will be talking exclusively in a BBC interview that I found from last year. He had a lot of interesting things to say, followed by the exiled prince, son of the Shah, will be the queen herself, the queen of Iran, the wife of Mohammad Pahlavi, the late Shah of Iran, Queen Farah. And she will be here on an interview with Charlie Rose a few years ago. I am hoping and praying I can get Reza Pahlavi in the near future, an actual live guest. And that's going to take a little bit of work. He is the international spokesman for the Iran National Council. And so I look forward to connecting with him and having him later as a guest on my program. But we will go with the interview today. He has a lot of interesting things to say. Coming up this Thursday, my dear friend Naghmeh Abedini, the wife of Saeed Abedini. Saeed has not had a visitor in over 5-6 weeks now. His father is in another country visiting his family and will be gone for at least approximately another 3 weeks. This has been a really trying time for Naghmeh. But this Thursday, she will join me right here live on The Cross in the Desert with Tiffany Barnes from the American Center of Law and Justice. You don't want to miss that program. What I want to do before I do this interview, I want to bring you to a letter, an article written by Tiffany Barrons just recently from the ALC, from the American Center of Law and Justice. And she had a few things to say about the situation with Saeed still in prison. Tiffany writes, "The Obama administration has finalized a historic nuclear deal with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Meanwhile, American pastor Saeed Abedini, a U.S. citizen, remains the target of abuse in an Iranian prison. For the last month, little information has been available about Pastor Saeed's well-being because all family-permitted prison visitations are currently out of the country. The government of Iran has rejected all pleas for sanctioned phone calls between Pastor Saeed and his wife and children. But an Iranian human rights news source published this week that Pastor Saeed was again the victim of an aggressive inspection at the prison. Human rights activist news agency reported on Wednesday that Pastor Saeed's condition in Rajah Shahar prison was very worrisome. And then on August 6th, prison guards raided Pastor Saeed's prison cell once again. The news agency reports that Saeed was the sole target of the raid and that the guards' actions towards Pastor Saeed were dishonorable and harsh. As members of Congress are currently contemplating whether to approve or reject the Iranian nuclear deal, they must also be cognizant of the Americans being held hostage and targeted in Iranian prisons. Pastor Saeed is anything but political, yet the Iranian regime continues to hold this innocent man hostage." Tiffany writes, "We must send a message to Iran that Iran must immediately release Pastor Saeed and other imprisoned Americans." In a recent post by the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, Hadi Gahami, executive director of the campaign, stated, quote, "The Iranian government wants the world to look the other way while these Americans are prosecuted under bogus charges and without any semblance of due process languish in Iranian prisons. Rouhani can't have it both ways. If he wants to end Iran's international power status, he should use all his authority to end the unlawful targeting of these dual nationals," said Gahami. "Whatever benefit the Iranian regime believes it may receive from continuing to hold Pastor Saeed and the other Americans, the American government and the international community must make it clear that unjustly imprisoning innocent men and holding hostages is against the international community. As we aggressively fight in Congress and across the globe for Pastor Saeed's freedom, please take action with us by signing the petition." And, of course, that petition is up on my page. It is also through the BeHeardProject.com, BeHeardProject.com. You can also go there and also sign the petition. I want you to hear this very important letter written by Pastor Saeed more than 2.5 years ago, and Nagme has had this on her Facebook page. It's called In Chains for Christ. Let's listen.
When I heard that empty Christmas settings were placed during Christmas as a reminder of my imprisonment and those imprisoned for Christ, tears of joy filled my eyes. I was able to share about this with other prisoners, and they were shocked by the love and support we have for each other in Jesus. I told them how in the Bible we are all considered brothers and sisters, despite race, color, or nationality, and we are able to share in each other's pains. This comes from our Lord. The Word of God says that when we are persecuted for our faith, we are to count it all joy. When I think that all of these trials and persecutions are being recorded in heaven for me, my heart is filled with complete joy. The Bible says that the joy of the Lord is our strength. Without the joy of the Lord, we cannot live. It is this joy in our life that gives us strength to continue in this life. Without strength, we cannot continue the work of the Lord, and without joy, there is no strength. I always wanted God to make me a godly man. I did not realize that in order to become a godly man, we need to become like steel under pressure. it is a hard process of warm and cold to make steel. This is the process in my life today. One day I am told I will be freed and allowed to see my family and kids on Christmas, which was a lie. And the next day I am told I will hang for my faith in Jesus. One day there are intense pains after beatings and interrogations. The next day they are nice to you and offer you candy. These hot and cold days only make you a man of steel for moving forward and expanding his kingdom. I am looking forward to the day I can see all of you who are behind me with your prayers and to embrace you in my arms. Thank you for the love you have shown me. What is in us is stronger than what is in the world, and it has conquered the world. Pastor Saeed Abendini, in chains for our Lord Jesus Christ. The ACLJ is...
That was one of the first letters ever written by Saeed, and that was in Evan Prison, and that was from February 2013. Please continue to pray and speak out for Saeed, and the petition is on my Facebook page. Just scroll down. I will post it closer up to the top a little bit later after this broadcast. And don't forget, this Thursday, Nagme will be my guest on The Cross in the Desert, and she will talk about the upcoming prayer visual for Saeed, which is September 26th. That time is coming that much closer to us. Time is moving so fast. Right now, what I want to do, I want to play this very special interview from the exiled prince and the son of the former Shah of Iran. This is Reza Pahlavi in an interview from last year with the BBC, right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
35 years ago, early in 1979, the Iranian Revolution swept away the Shah and his governing administration and swept in the Ayatollah Khomeini, who created the world's first Islamic Republic. And Iran's turbulent relations with the West and with America in particular have now spanned four decades. But before Christmas last year, President Hassan Rouhani did signal a potentially new departure and a possible compromise, a possible move on Iran's disputed nuclear program. In a moment, I'll be speaking to Reza Pahlavi, the last crown prince of Iran, son of the late Shah. Thank you so much for joining us. With you in a second. I just want to explain a little more background to viewers before I talk to you. Thank you very much. On the 1st of February 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran following 14 years in exile. By 1989, a decade later, Ali Khamenei was appointed supreme leader following years of troubled international relations and the death of Ayatollah Khomeini. In August of 2005, the arrival of President Ahmadinejad oversaw a period of worsening ties with the West, and especially with the nuclear program proving to be an increasingly contentious issue. Last year, Hassan Rouhani won the presidential election. He said he was ready for serious and substantive talks over pretty much everything, but certainly over the country's nuclear program. So, as promised, Reza Pahlavi is with me, the last crown prince of Iran who fled the country with the rest of his family following that revolution in 1979, now based in the USA, and spokesman for the Iran National Council for Free Elections. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
When I said there that the new president is open to suggestions, is open to dialogue, is open to talk with Americans and the rest of the countries in the West, is it your view that he's genuine in that offer?
Well, as the saying goes, action speaks louder than words. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons I'm here today is to offer a report on the violation of human rights in the last 6 months ever since the current president has taken over, which is more than the amount of people that were executed in the previous 6 months since his arrival to office. So what has been said is not very much in correlation to what has been done. As a matter of fact, it saddens me to hear a U.S. president say that this dialogue is no longer based on trust, but by the results of actual actions. Where there was an element of trust once in my country has disappeared as a result of the regime's actual behavior. So it remains to be seen. I am always a proponent of trying to solve the problem diplomatically. I wish we could have had real reforms, even at the time of the first talk of reforms during Khatami, and now we hear the same music, so to speak. But in reality, what are we going to be faced with, we'll have to see.
What is the agenda?
Well, if you're talking simply on the nuclear issue, obviously everybody is looking at any denouement in that direction. But as an Iranian, and I'm millions of Iranians who have often stated towards the outside world, the free world, that the issue should not be just the issue of nuclear, the nuclear issue, but the lack of freedom in Iran, the abuse, systematic violation of human rights in Iran. This is something that we want as a nation to not only obtain, but we don't see that ever occur under the current regime. And ultimately, it's only a secular democratic system that can provide us with that respite.
I mentioned that you're based in the States and that you went into exile in 79. To what extent is it possible for you to maintain contacts with people in Iran today and get a really good sense of what's going on there?
Well, fortunately, technology has been, since 1979, quite different. I recall the days I was in Cairo, you hardly had a free line to call the outside. There was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no internet or satellite transmission. So whether it's someone like me or media, when people can, in fact, communicate with one another, that's the main means, using various technologies to be in touch with my fellow compatriots. I've always been, from the very beginning, living and breathing Iran. That has been the center of my attention. But as we progress in time, better means of communication facilitated much better access and therefore means of communications and dialogue.
And what are you picking up from that?
Well, certainly there's a direct correlation of dissatisfaction with today's youth that after 35 years and what they hear particularly from their parents, because they are the innocent generation that have inherited this mess and had nothing to do with. What happened? Where was the country going? Where are we now? And most importantly, where do we need to go? And that's really the issue and that is often discussed. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I helped create the National Council for Free Elections is because at the end of the day, it's about sovereignty of the people. And at the end of the day, it has to come to the ability to conduct free elections so that we can measure what people want. Mm. And we cannot have this under this regime. We have asked for this regime to cave in. The first act of our council was to write a letter to Mr. Khamenei and say, listen, this is what's absolutely needed if you want to measure what, in a true sense, is the will of the people. And if you're not going to cave in voluntarily, we have no choice but to conduct this campaign until the day we have a climate in Iran where, in fact, we can conduct free elections.
Do you resent suggestions from people who say that because of your family's history and because of your late father's way of governing, you are not in a position to offer views on this? Do you resent people when they say that to you?
Well, I think that anybody in their right mind knows that anyone is his own man or woman, and we are all entitled to our own opinion and might have our own vision. And I think today the reason why many of my compatriots, irrespective of what opinion they might have of the past, focus on what it is that I propose is because it's exactly in tune with what they have demanded for a long time and is definitely in tune with what the young people of Iran today seek. And at the end of the day, it's all about their means to exercise their freedom and self-determination by means of have the liberty to choose for themselves as opposed to be dictated to how they ought to live, breathe, dress, or anything. Simple things. And, of course, in a much grander scale, an absolute necessity of compatibility with a free world.
When, and we're seeing some images now of your family and we see your late father there, I'm just wondering, in the context of what we see today, for example, in Egypt or even in Syria, some other countries too, to what extent has that affected the views of especially young people in Iran? Do they look at the example of Egypt, for example, and you see the dreadful division and split there, even today, and do they then sort of step back a bit and think, well, hang on a second, do we really want to get ourselves into a position where we are looking at a decade of conflict here?
Well, you raise a very critical point. First of all, many of these movements that followed what happened with the Green Movement in Iran that gave rise to the so-called Arab Spring, in fact, was inspired by Iran, not the other way around. What's most important is that Iran is the only country, unlike other countries in the Middle East or North Africa, that have lived under a dictatorship, religious dictatorship, for 35 years. So the issue of secularism, the necessity for separation of religion from state and governance as a prerequisite to democracy, is well understood in Iran. And being secular does not mean by far being anti-religious. It simply means that religious governance is inherently the rule of one specific ideology, which is in direct contradiction to freedom of conscience or faith or ideology anywhere. So what is missing, however, is, and it's a very legitimate question, is how can a vacuum be filled if there is a change? And in fact, one of the key elements that has to be part of our discourse is not just to say that we will have a constitution and a new parliament and a new system, but democracy on a daily basis is ultimately the rivalries between political parties in formational governance. If there's an absence of strengthening civil components of civil society as well as political parties, even if you have a change of regime, even if you have the best secular constitution, you will not be able to have the appropriate mechanisms through which society can exercise its democratic rights. And we need to focus on this as of now. For instance, using Egypt as an example, I would like to say that if for some reason during the Cold War, one might have, in terms of realpolitik, understood that many Western democracies supported many governments that were not quote-unquote democratic. But ever since the breakdown of the Soviet Union, there was no longer the excuse not to liberalize. Was there any attempt to try to reform and liberalize since 1985, as opposed to wait 25 years later and face a crisis that led to the Arab Spring? But because there were no instances planned for, because there were no political parties formed, because civil society was not strengthened, all of a sudden one leader comes down and what fills the vacuum? And then people say, oh my God, what's going to happen in Syria in a post-Assad, or what happens in Egypt? That's not the case in Iran. But that doesn't mean we ought not think about these things. Because let's suppose tomorrow the Islamic regime is no longer in power. What is going to ultimately fill the gap? We need to think all this. This has to be thought engineered as of now. And that's an important debate, which is, in fact, quite tangible, because this is precisely what the youth are saying. It's not just we want freedom, we want liberty, but how are we going to, in fact, implement it after the change occurs?
Viewers will want me to ask you one more question, which is, can you foresee a time when you might return to Iran?
You know, I wish I had a prediction ball. It's very hard to tell how long it will take, but I can say only one this thing. In terms of history, this regime is condemned to disappear. It's almost like Iran in 35 years had a major wound where the new skin has formed underneath. And what you see remaining on top is a scab that eventually would fall. Now, is it going to fall in 2 years, in 5 years, or 10 years? It's very difficult to measure. But the important thing is not change for the sake of change. People said that 34 years ago. Let's get rid of the Shah, then see what happens. Result, a regime that very few people actually put more thought or sense into it, but by the time everyone realized it was too late. So this time we cannot simply say, this regime has been bad, everybody knows that. We need to get rid of it, everybody knows that. At least the majority of the Iranian people want that. But it's not enough just to say we don't want this. We have to also understand what it is that we want. What would the alternative be? How do we get there? And so on. So that's part of the whole, if you will, debate going on at home, irrespective of today's circumstances.
Mr. Pahlavi, very good of you to come in. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
The insights of Reza Pahlavi, the exiled prince and son of the former Shah of Iran, on a BBC interview from 2014. Looking forward to having him right here on The Cross in the Desert in the near future. And I appreciate his insights. He seems to have a grasp of the situation. I like that he quoted the youth, because the youth are crying out for democracy and freedom every day. And my program is just one in many, many programs reaching out to try its best to secure their freedom and democracy through speaking out, through signing petitions, for praying as well. I want us to hear now a very special interview from Queen Farah, the wife of the late Shah of Iran. This is with Charlie Roses a few years ago, but this is so rare and it's such a beautiful interview. I want you to hear this right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Farah Pahlavi's book is called An Enduring Love. In 1959, when she was 21, she married the former Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. During her 20-year reign as empress, she worked to boost women's rights, eradicate illiteracy, and establish a forum for the arts. In 1979, she and her husband were forced to flee their country after the rise of a new Islamic republic led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. Her new book, as I said, is called An Enduring Love, and it talks about her life with the Shah, and I am pleased to have her here to talk about that. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell me when you first met him.
Well, the first time I met him from close was in Paris when I was a student of architecture, and I was very proud, of course, to have been introduced to him. But really, it was our real encounter was in Tehran when I returned for summer vacation in 59.
And you were how old?
I was exactly 20 years old then.
And how did you see him then?
I was invited to see his daughter from the previous marriage, and I was delighted to meet her, and then the king arrived. And I said, well, it's an accident, it's normal, then a father comes and visits her daughter. And then he really put me at ease and started to ask me questions about my student life and the students abroad. And that's how it all started.
And then how long was it before?
It was
you knew this was serious.
August that we met, and close to October I realized that it was not an accident, because we met several times afterwards.
Yeah.
And we spoke, and he took me around, that something serious is happening.
What kind of man did you marry?
I had always an admiration for him as a king and as a patriot. He was really someone who loved his country and its people, and humanly he was such a civilized man, so human, so just, so affectionate, and a loving husband and a loving father.
1967, you were crowned queen. Now, how long had you been married to the Shah before you were crowned queen?
We married in 1959.
So 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why did it take 8 years to crown you queen?
Because it was his own coronation also. He always said, I don't want to be crowned before my people are getting going through development and their condition of living is better. And then again, the crown of crowning the queen for me, as I always said, when he crowned me, as if he had crowned all the women of Iran.
You represented all the women of Iran, you think?
Yes, yes. And I think many Iranian women felt the same way. Of course, in our past history, thousands of years ago, we had women as reigning queens, but it didn't happen all these years.
Was it the happiest time of your life after you were, when you were lived before the revolution, when you were in Iran, when he was in power, and all Jimmy Carter and all the other presidents would come, and all those Americans who had a relationship with Iran would come to Iran and celebrate it, and you had the power of oil and all of that?
You know, beside my own happiness, my personal happiness as a wife, as a mother, and as a person who was active in so many activities, it was the happiness of the country going forward to development, to modernity, to progress, to compare the condition of Iran and the Iranians 25 years ago. And unfortunately, these people came and promised paradise, and they opened the door to hell. And to me, what has happened in Iran is really a catastrophe with mythological dimension.
Mythological damage?
Mythological damage.
What's the mythological damage?
Because it's so huge, it's so horrible, that I cannot
comprehend
or accept that a country like Iran, which was one of the cradles of civilization, we had such good relations with the rest of the world, the area was stable, we had peace, the country was developing, modernizing, going towards progress, and now it has become the center of international terrorism and religious fanaticism.
So how do you explain the fact that the Islamic Revolution was successful?
It has many...
When your husband had all that army that he had.
Well, it has different causes, interior and exterior. Of course, there were shortcomings of mistakes committed, but we could have or should have handled or addressed the problems better.
Which problems?
Well, of different dissatisfaction of people for different things. Like, for instance, when you put one foot forward, there are also difficulties which arise, but you have to address them.
And you think he failed to address them perhaps because his... for whatever reason, and that therefore it sowed the seeds for the revolution?
Well, you know, let us not forget the context of that period. It was during the Cold War.
Right.
Our big neighbor, the Soviet Union, always dreamt to reach the warm waters of the Persian Gulf. We had all the communist groups inside of Iran, and we were victim of international terrorism because three prime ministers were assassinated twice, attempted the life of my husband, and some American citizens, officers were killed in Iran. So there were these groups who were very attached to ideology of communism, and also the other side, the fundamentalists, that they have shown what they wanted for Iran, and they were unhappy for development progress and women's rights. So all that gave together, and also, unfortunately, all the pressure from outside that encouraged opposition and, in a way, discouraged the government. But again, what I want to say, with your permission, is this is the past. We have to look.
And I'm going to move toward it, but, there is too much history here for me not to talk to you about it, because you were part of that history.
Yes.
I promise to get to the future. And the book, because the book is about a love story, as you say, an enduring love. My life with the Shah, and we're talking about your life with the Shah, as you know. And we'll talk about your son in a moment. But let me just say, when did you know it was over, that you were going to have to flee the country? Did you know a week before, 2 weeks before? Did you all have an inevitability about it?
Yes, I will answer to this question. But enduring love means at the same time love of my husband and love of my country, Iran. You know, almost 10 days, a week before we left, we were discussing that maybe we have to leave, maybe it will calm down the situation, this mass hysteria, just a week before.
How difficult and how disappointed and frustrated and angry was he about the fact that he had a hard time finding a place to live out the rest of his life? And it only was the intervention of people like David Rockefeller and others that it happened.
Well, you know, all this time, I always say, since he was a very good pilot, he was really looking at the world from another level. I think the pilots see the world differently. He never complained. And
even when he was suffering from cancer?
No, because we, although humanly, it was very hard to understand. But in politics, governments are for their political interests and economical interests. And the regime had changed. But at the same time, now I think of President Sadat, to whom and to the Egyptians, which I will always remain grateful.
Because they allowed him to come to Egypt,
and he showed also that even in politics, moral values count.
Sadat did.
Yes.
His body is still in Egypt. Is that correct?
It's still in Egypt.
The tomb is in Egypt.
In Egypt.
Well, do you visit Egypt?
Every year I go to Egypt to visit his tomb for the commemoration, and it's a pleasure for me always to go back to Egypt, and always with the hope that one day we could take him back to our own country.
You would like to take him back to Tehran?
Yes.
Do you think that will ever happen?
I think it will. I have confidence in the future of Iran. Iran is important, not only for the Iranians today, but for the peace and stability in the Middle East and for the rest of the free world. And I have confidence in Iranian women, in the youth of Iran. And also they have shown lately after the so-called elections that they are rejecting the system.
A very, very insightful and rare interview with Queen Farah and Charlie Rose from 6 years ago, just a rare but very insightful interview as she recalled those disastrous last days when her and her husband and family were exiled and had to leave Iran. Right now I have a very special guest on hold. His name is Kaveh Tahiri. He is a journalist and human rights activist, and he joins us live from Turkey right now on the cross in the desert. I want to say welcome, Kaveh. Live from Turkey, welcome to the cross in the desert.
Hello, everyone, and thanks a lot for inviting me to discuss such an important issue.
Well, Kaveh, please introduce yourself and tell the audience how long you have been a human rights activist.
I appreciate the chance you gave me to be part of this panel discussion. I am an Iranian human rights journalist based in Turkey. I was a former political prisoner due to my writing in my blog and website. I was arrested by Iran's intelligence service officials in 2012 and taken to detention for about 10 months. I had been in the intelligence service chamber known as Pelagstat in the city of Shiraz about 59 days, and after that, the officials delivered me to Adelabad prison, where I had spent about 8 months of my prison term.
Well, Kaveh, how was your situation in Iran before you have come here to Turkey? Tell us about that.
As I told you in the first response, I had been in Adelabad prison for a while among non-political prisoners as gangs and criminals, because the prison has not a specific ward for political prisoners, and we were mixed in with dangerous and violent criminals who put our lives in danger. I was kept in Ward 11, the notorious ward named Neshat, meaning happiness. It was not cheerful as its name claims, and the majority of prisoners were kept there. There were 30 rooms on two floors, and each room was up 20 meters, including about 700 to 1,400 inmates, depending on the time of year. In most months, about 25 to 30 prisoners were in one room. That means each prisoner had only 1 meter of room. And there were 30 toilets for both floors and 20 showers, of which 5 were usually broken. The prisoners were allowed to go outside only for 20 or 30 minutes, two or three times per week. The food situation is absolutely dreadful. No hygiene, health standards are followed for food preparation. Often we find a mouse or a cockroach at the bottom of the large pot we share.
It's horrible.
The food quality and quantity are both very inappropriate. There is a plate in the Neshat section which is called the gas kitchen, which the prisoners use daily for cooking and making tea. This kitchen is very dirty and contaminated with bacteria. It often causes sickness. And the prison is very cold in the winter and very hot in the summer. This makes the prison situation even more unbearable. This section never has appropriate temperature and no heater or air conditioning a little there. There are three issues that will shock you in Nesha's section. One, there are dealings. Second, suddenly, and the third one, gambling. The guards witness these, and they also have in hand in. Guards are easily brought into prison. I have been witness to the guards bringing in guards into prison. Guards easily exchange hands there, and prisoners openly use drugs in their room. Section 10 has almost the same conditions, and it is allocated mostly for murderers.
That is unbelievable, Kaveh, just horrible. Can you describe the procedure of interrogation?
I already described it, part of the critical condition in Iran's jail. Adelabad prison is an unbelievable example in the country. Yet Adelabad is not the one rare goal of imprisonment in horrible situation. Many reports have been received from prisons throughout Iran about the lack of health care facilities, clean water, poor nutrition, and sanitation. These reports have been received from Karun, Adelabad, Bandar Abbas, Vakil Abad, and many other prisons in Iran. But let me unfold the procedures and the methods of interrogation. The medieval tortures are a bigger memorial that Iran's authorities have been using against the dissidents. Iran's officials have reportedly exercised brutal methods to force the offenders and regime dissidents by both intelligence service and intelligence division of Iran's national police forces. And the method: the broken captives are victimized by savage methods such as fire seat, drip shower, pulling fingernails, hanging from the ceiling, flogging, high voltage shocking, injecting sharp injects into the sensitive organs, burning the sensitive organs as face, hips, and testes. Sexual torture at risk of rape, sexual work, or touching, robbing, and beating to sex organs. Keeping in unclean cells, keeping in cold and hot water, hot weather, and roast chicken torture. Captive legs are pulled up, their arms over their legs, and a broom stick put between their arms and legs. Their hands are then tied up, and then the officers do what they want with the captive. And the other method of torture, thumb screw. The torturer puts the captive's hand into a clamp to crush it.
That is just horrible and inhumane, Kaba.
Yeah.
Your Facebook page shows that you're really concerned about a Mr. Tahiri. Please tell us who he is and why he is considered such a threat to the Islamic regime in Iran. Is he a political threat, or is he dangerous for Islam?
No. Mr. Tahiri has not ever been a threat to Islam as we know. He is only a messenger of peace and relaxation by his peaceful theories. And the other beliefs would not be tolerated and accepted by mullahs, except the state religion, Islam. Dr. Muhammad Ali Tahiri is an Iranian physician, researcher, and author in the field of interuniversalism alternative medicine, who is recently convicted to the death penalty by the Islamic Revolutionary Court. And he is the founder of a spiritual group known as Erfane Halqe. Mr. Tahiri was sentenced to capital punishment on the charge of Ifsad fil Ard, as spreading corruption on earth, under Iran's Islamic Penal Code. And he has been in Evin prison since 2011, and he also started a dry hunger strike for 25 days to protest against his unfair isolation inside World 2A of Iran's Revolutionary Guard forces in the prison in November 2014. Hereof, Amnesty International also expressed their concern about Mr. Tahiri's situation in a statement on August 2014. The UN's top human rights official also has expressed alarm at death sentence imposed on an alternative health practitioner in Iran. Mr. Tahiri also previously asked Ahmed Shahid, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran, to review his case by sending an open letter in April 2014. Mr. Tahiri, like the other Iranian activists, have been victimized of regime's inhuman pleasure, and we are already convinced that Iran's regime is absolutely invariable.
Mr. Tahiri is just one of the thousands of Iranians under the suppression of the Islamic regime in Iran, Kaba. As a human rights activist, how do you think of human rights during the past four decades compared with its situation in the Middle East? As we know, during Rouhani's time, the rate of execution has tripled. It has increased despite his promises. And while Mr. Zarif claimed that the regime does not jail people for their opinions, we see a lot of people are in prison for very funny reasons and even lose their life due to their opinions.
Yes, he's not just one of the thousands of Iranians under the suppression and persecution since the tenure of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979. Iran's regime has turned the death machine due to crackdown on dissidents since 1979. The executions were raised after all extremism, fundamentalism, and reactionism, which conducted by extremist groups, both part of authorities and opposition, as some theorists have believed. The regime of Iran had sentenced many civil political prisoners and even religious minorities as Baha'is to death through summarily interrogating and severe torture in 18. Massacre had continued in late July 1988, that carried on into fall. That included politicians and intellectuals, as many as 30,000 dissidents may have been executed. The human rights violations is being continued to Rouhani's presidential period, including more than 1,900 executions in his presidential period at the moment. In the first 6 months of this year, more than 3 executions by gallows per day. It means every 2 hours per day, a defendant was executed in Iran. Prison officials had caught the offensive's finger in central Mashhad prison yard on 28 June 2015. Another offender forcibly lost his left leg and his right hand on Monday morning on August 2015. Branch 2 at the Islamic Revolutionary Court of Mashhad held the verdict as a legal punishment under Islamic penal code. Still, the other offenses unroll the resembling sentence. And a young Iranian man who had blinded a taxi driver's left eye was convicted to blinding one of his eyes under the Islamic penal code Qisas as retaliation in kind in 1st of August 2015. Hassan Rouhani and his foreign minister are akin to a wolf in sheep's clothing. They, as the other Iranian officials, are not reliable based on their attitude. Iran's foreign minister, Mr. Mohammad Javad Zarif, who has led the nuclear negotiations for the Islamic Republic of Iran for the past 20 months, stated, "We do not jail people for their opinion." And President Hassan Rouhani had also promised the release of political prisoners during his presidential campaign in 2013. And Rouhani promised a more moderate government with much reform to allow freedom. But in fact, arrests and executions have escalated under Rouhani by all accounts. Furthermore, President Rouhani gave assurance for many Iranians who had left Iran during the 2009 unrest to return without consequences, which was certainly not true. Many were arrested, jailed, and given stiff sentences upon return. Ismail Gerami Moghaddam, Saeed Pur Haydar, Majid Moghaddam, Hamid Babai, Mustafa Azizi, Sarajeddin Mirdamadi, Hossein Nourani Nejad, Gonche Qawami, and Royal Nobakh were indeed arrested for their opinions, and some of them were returned to Iran.
Kava, observing different types of human rights violations, the world does not take any measures to help this nation. Do you think the situation in the Middle East has any influence on ignoring the situation in Iran?
Of course it does as well. Human rights situation in Iran would be overshadowed while the region involved with war and terrorism, because anything else would be a priority, and the international community forcibly concerned to the crisis. And I would like to draw your attention to the situation that neither human rights nor popular interest cared by both Western governments, human rights organizations, human rights, and some issues like that are just an excuse to pressure to the third estate that lead them to obey to Western. We have seen dozens executions and unfair sentences against dissidents by the regime just a few hours after the nuclear treaty was signed in Vienna.
Okay. Kaveh, I'll have one last question for you. In spite of obvious horrible human rights violations in Iran, President Obama started a deal with this regime. How do you justify or disagree with this deal? Do you really believe that there will be a war if they do not sign this agreement?
Good point. I'm absolutely against any negotiation with executor estates. I have spent my life advocating for peace, justice, and freedom in Iran. I am seriously worried about human rights violations in Iran. I must warn about the dangerousness of this regime. This deal will unblock Iran's assets, which will provide up to $150 billion windfall of cash into the regime's bank. This money won't be spent for the Iranian citizens, but rather to enrich the regime and ongoing human rights violations to be continued. I'm sounding the alarm bells before it is too late. Unblocking regime assets surely upholds executor mullahs supporting their allies as Assad's regime and some terrorist groups in the region. Unfortunately, international community has not demanded real improvements in human rights, and dozens of Iranian human rights veterans and we have expressed concern about human rights situation in Iran. Hundreds civil political activists are behind bars, including several Americans, and it is shamelessly that their release was not included in the discussion. Today in Iran, political and religious prisoners are tortured. Journalists and educators remain in the jail. Women are treated as second-class citizens. And you asked me about war. Let me ask you a question, dear Randy. Has Vietnam had nuke weapons? Or Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya? These countries have been attacked by Western superpowers as well. Superpowers will start war as sure as they can. I mean that agreements and treaties will not prevent war. If we look at recent history, we'll find that superpowers have always had the protection of their colonies and fight for it. And I have to say that Western governments, especially United States, are responsible to the tragic events in the region. The people we are fighting today, we founded 20 years ago, as Hillary Clinton said. They founded to fight with Soviet Union. Finally, I again appreciate the chance I have been given to unfold the horrible situation of Iran. In the end, I want superpowers throwing over their inhuman plot in Middle East. I believe that the countries in the Middle East could be overcome their internal crisis by their own mass power as social awareness. Foreign intervention won't solve the situation. Neither West nor anyone else can give them democracy. Democracy can be earned, not given. Thank you, dear.
Thank you so much, Kavi Tahari, calling us live here on the Cross in the Desert, all the way from Turkey, and it's over an hour into the evening. It's about 7 p.m. there, and thank you, Kavi, as a journalist and human rights activist, for sharing your experience in prison. We're thankful you're alive, that you are a strong and powerful voice for human rights. Thank you for answering the questions and sharing with us the deplorable situation of human rights in Iran. Thank you so much for posting your articles on my timeline that keeps me and all of my Iranian friends aware of what's happening in Iran. Thank you, Kaveh. God bless you for being a guest on the Cross in the Desert.
Thank you, too. Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye.
I really appreciate Kaveh taking the time to enlighten us, to educate us, and to share with us the deplorable situation of human rights. And as I mentioned, he shares all of these articles about the situation in Iran on my Facebook, and in turn, I share them with you, and there are many times petitions and other times articles, but please, please pay attention to them. He keeps us informed about what's happening, and also that we can participate and be a voice of hope and freedom for Iranians. So again, Kaveh, thank you for your time. I want to take us to a lighter type of the program right now. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I want to share with you an incredible Christian musician who has enriched and influenced my life since I became a Christian more than 36 years ago. And I listened to a lot of secular hard rock music, but when I discovered Phil Keaggy, I found a musician, an artist, and a powerful human being communicating the truth of God's word. And so what I want to do is invite you for the next 25 minutes to listen to this amazing talent right now on the Cross in the Desert. And this is a series called The Sound Check. So we're going to hear from him in just a minute.
Well, friends, this is Phil Keaggy here, and I'm glad to be with you, if not in person, at least in spirit. You know, 25 years ago, I wrote this song. The lyrics started in the waiting room of a hospital where my wife Bernadette was having tests. We had lost babies 3 times, and premature births and miscarriage. And so she was expecting our daughter, Alicia. Alicia came through fine. But while waiting in that hospital room, just 2 weeks before Alicia was born in March of 1980, I was so aware at that moment of time that so many little babies don't make it. And so I wrote this song for the unborn. And I've had many people over the years tell me how much this song has meant to them. Called Little Ones. Who will speak up for the little ones, helpless and half abandoned? They've got a right to choose life they don't want to lose. I've got to speak up, won't you?
Musician himself, Phil Keaggy, a beautiful tribute to the unborn. And of course, we know about the horrible way that Planned Parenthood is treating the fetuses of and selling body parts. It's just horrible and unthinkable. And I'm very thankful that my brother Phil has written this song as a tribute to those sacrificed on the altar of convenience and inconvenience, that is. Beautiful song, a tribute to the unborn, a mantra, if you will, for the pro-life movement, this song, from his CD and album called Flipside. I want you to hear another beautiful song. Phil Keaggy plays acoustic, electric, every device, musically speaking, but he is a champion of the acoustic guitar. He formed a band way back in the 70s called Glass Harp, actually recorded some of their first songs in Electric Ladyland Studios, which was owned by Jimi Hendrix at that time. Phil Keaggy has met just international famous people. He actually performed at Paul McCartney's sister's wedding, and also they got a chance to jam together. So Phil has been an incredible influence on the lives of top musicians all over the world. I want to feature a song right now from him. It's a beautiful song of meditation. It's like that song you would play in your quiet time as a Christian, of meditation and praise to Christ. This one is called Let Everything Else Go.
Play.
What an amazing talent. That's Mr. Phil Keaggy, master musician, Let Everything Else Go. I want to feature right now Phil at his best. This is a particular song that has become kind of a classic when he plays with his entire band. It's featuring him on the Les Paul and all of the different effects, and he's talking about an issue that in this life there is time to turn and to come to faith in Christ. But after this life, as the Bible says, it's appointed unto man once to die, and after this is the judgment. This is a song talking about we have precious little time. And I want you to hear the amazing gift that God has given Phil Keaggy on this song. Let's listen.
Won't always be, but
That is the music of Phil Kagi, the incredible master musician Phil Kagi and the Phil Kagi Band, a song called Time. I really want to thank Laurie, Kevin, Sharin, and everyone in the chat room today. So appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to come to my program, The Cross in the Desert. We've been hearing today from Reza Pahlavi, an interview from last year, and also Queen Farah on insights and remembering Iran, remembering the dynasty of the Shah, remembering the way things used to be before the brutal butchers of the Islamic State and Khomeini came to power in 1979. We also heard from Kaba Tahari, live from Turkey, calling in. Thank you, Kaba, and talking to us about the deplorable situation of human rights in Iran and bringing to our attention the case of Muhammad Ali Tahari, who is on death row. He's a practicing religious person being persecuted and discriminated against because of his religious belief. But this goes on 24/7 in Iran. And this is why I have a program to be a voice of hope and freedom and support for my dear Iranian friends. I want to thank you so much for your participation today. Don't forget, this Thursday, Nagme Abedini, the wife of Saeed Abedini, currently lingering in prison in Iran. She will be my guest. We're going to talk about this situation. We're going to talk about her reaction to this nuclear arrangement and the upcoming prayer vigil. Thank you so much. I pray that you have an incredible week, and I will see you again on Thursday on The Cross in the Desert.
My night.